I think what it does is open someone to the possibility, the likelihood that something else is possible beyond that which academia tells us. And the artistic research mode is one way that you can wield this currency that is artistic research.
Welcome to the Ledgers Podcast in our Arts Research Africa dialogue series. These dialogues are intended to stimulate practice, enable research, and inspire collective engagement around the question of artistic research in Africa. I'm Prof. Christa Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts. In this dialogue, I'll be speaking to Russell Hlongwane, an artist whose work pushes boundaries, reshapes narratives, and bridges the often complex interplay between heritage and innovation. Russell is a visionary South African artist, cultural producer, and filmmaker from KwaZulu-Natal. Russell's work, deeply rooted in Zulu tradition, examines how indigenous knowledge systems intersect with global modernity. Through his multidisciplinary approach, often interrogating and reimagining the tropes of Afrofuturism, he crafts performances, installations, and films that not only challenge conventional notions of art, but also provoke reflection on cultural memory, displacement, and the future of African identity. In this episode, we explore Russell's artistic journey, from his early years growing up in between Durban and rural Msinga to his emergence as one of the most compelling voices in African contemporary art. A central aspect of Russell's practice includes artistic research, which informs his creative producing, design, and curatorship. Russell is a member of a number of collectives, working groups, and programs spread across the SADC region, the continent, and internationally, and is on the International Advisory Board for the Prince Claus Fund. He is currently studying towards the Southern Urbanism MPhil at the African Center for Cities at the University of Cape Town. Russell shares how his upbringing in a province steeped in Zulu history inspired his interest in exploring ancestral wisdom, storytelling, and ritual in his work. He reveals how he uses these elements to interrogate issues of colonial legacy, globalization, and the digitization of culture. One of the highlights of our conversation is Russell's unique perspective on the role of performance art in society. He speaks candidly about how his live performances, often incorporating music, movement, and spoken word, aim to create communal experiences that resonate across generations. His work is a call to remember, to reconnect with histories that are often erased or misrepresented, while imagining technological futures that are deeply rooted in African cosmologies. We also delve into his filmmaking, a medium he describes as a meeting point of time and space. Russell's films are known for their experimental narratives, blending documentary and fiction to explore themes of migration, urbanization, and African identity. He discusses the challenges and joys of working within an African context, where resources may be limited, but the stories and creative potential are boundless. Throughout our conversation, Russell emphasizes the importance of collaboration and community in his practice. Whether working with musicians, traditional healers, or other young filmmakers, he views art as a collective effort to make sense of a rapidly changing world while holding onto the threads of what makes us human. This episode is more than just an interview. It's an invitation to rethink how we perceive tradition, innovation, and the intersections between them. Russell Hlongwane's work is a reminder that African art is not static. It is a living, breathing entity that continues to evolve, adapt, and inspire. Useful links to Russell's films and writings and the texts which have influenced his thinking can be found in the show notes for this podcast. Russell, welcome to the Aura Podcast. I still remember first encountering your work as a live performance artist, and it was at the 2018 ICEA in Durban, the first ever meeting of the International Society of Electronic Arts on the African soil. And really the high point for me of that entire event was your performance of Ifu Inyama, Dark Cloud. And what really struck me about it was how uncompromising it was, that you use Zulu for an audience that I think was largely non-African, and the entire performance was delivered in Zulu, and there was the conjunction of what you were projecting on the screen behind you
which is just like tech talk, and then your performance drawing on traditions of Zulu divination, and then the lecture performance that you gave directly to the audience. And obviously, being the ICEA conference in Africa, it raised all sorts of questions about technology, indigenous knowledge, the role of history, of understanding of context in how technology, science is to be understood or furthered in an African context. So that's where I'm coming from. It really blew my mind, made me think very differently about the potential for how technology and science can advance or be developed in Africa. So maybe take us back. What was your path that led you to a point that you could give a live performance like that in the Durban City Hall?
Thanks for the mention. I'm also thankful for the images that you had made for that performance. I would say that performance was kind of following an investigation with three other practitioners, two from Mozambique, João Rockshaw and Alexander Coelho, alongside Tegan Bristow. And we'd kind of spent some days under the guise of a project called Vernacular Algorithms, where we were investigating and looking at beadwork at the Panzer Museum, which is a kind of really rich museum in Durban. And somehow through that process, I'd felt that I was scratching the surfaces of something that I felt I kind of wanted to animate and stretch out in ways that were kind of filmic, that were performative and otherwise. And so that performance actually came together under very strained and very limited time constraints. So I'm blown away and I'm honored that you've spoken so positively about it, because it felt for me very dry, it felt very skeletal, if anything. And from that form, I've developed and I've tried to grow how I beef up this form of presentation, kind of working with theory in a very specific way, as well as performance, you know, and moving between the two has been something that, I guess, that was a seed. That performance you speak of was a seed from which a practice has emerged. I'm still developing the form of a performance lecture to this point. I feel I haven't quite captured it, but certainly that moment that you speak of was one place, or was a first place, where it put myself out of my comfort zone. Funny enough, out of that performance is the film Ifu Elimnyama. But I hope that kind of contextualizes where I was at the time and how that form had given birth to another form, which is a filmic form, and kind of things have grown since that point.
Let's go right back into your personal biography. And you were somebody who grew up in an urban context, but retained very strong links through female grandparents with probably one of the most intense parts of rural South Africa, which is Msinga. I actually once shot a documentary in Msinga for the Catholic Bishops Conference, and it was about the ongoing violence in that area. It's notorious for the violence. I also had some dealings with the Alcocks.
Uh-huh.
This was Neil Alcock, who was, in fact, assassinated in an ambush.
Right, coming from a meeting or something.
Yes, trying to actually, I think, settle some violent dispute between two different factions. And he was very interesting because he was an absolutely ardent advocate of alternative technologies, and lived with his family in the Msinga area, absolutely lived like a local, was subsequently assassinated. And yet his wife, Krina, stayed on and brought up two sons, one of whom now is a very passionate advocate for what he calls Khasi economics. But the two sons were absolutely fluent in Msinga Zulu. And one thing I've learned a lot over the years is that purest forms of languages, indigenous languages, black indigenous languages, are to be found usually in the deepest rural areas. So can you just talk a bit about what you got from your personal links, your family roots with somewhere like Msinga?
Yeah, I mean, where to start? I think it might be useful to kind of think between Umsinga and Durban, Overport in particular, where I was raised. Both my mother and my grandmother were domestic workers. And so this, by default, socializes you amongst a very particular group of people, mostly garden workers and domestic workers and service people in between. And the lives that they lead, or the extension of their lives from Umsinga into Durban, is a very interesting one, and has shaped my understanding of the world and my place in the world in a very specific way. Which is to say that there's a life and a kind of social orientation that this group of people take on in the city that has a lot to do with how they lead their lives in the rural area. And I also would want to move beyond the kind of the binary of rural versus urban and kind of think of the two as an extension of the other, you know, one being the extension of the other. And so as a result of this, there was a particular kind of language and a morphology of isiZulu, kind of a set of terms that one would encounter in Umsinga that take a different form and paint a different picture when they're used in Durban. At the same time, I was also socialized amongst, say, folk who identify or classified as Indian and white and so on. And so one was constantly moving between these two worldviews. And for a while, you have these two suits, if you want to use this term, one that you put on when you're in the one context and another that you put on in the other context. And I think what my work has tried to do is converge these two so that we can kind of read them, as I said, as an extension, right? And so this is the deep folklore that informs my work, is drawn from Umsinga. It's then further circulates in a particular way in Durban, for example. Some of the events, the phenomena that my work, particularly the focus on technology and indigeneity, a lot of that is drawing from Umsinga, and then it's utilizing an imagination that is quote-unquote urban, let's say science fiction and folklore, for example, is one thing that I kind of try to collapse together. I'm now interested in like spatial form, like rural spatial form, for example, as a way of like contributing towards a kind of spatial imagination that comes from the south, drawn from Umsinga once again, but you know, as you investigate these spatial forms, Umsinga, you'd have to draw out kind of towards the coast, kind of say the northern side of the province. And by virtue of that, you have to move further up towards Zimbabwe and further on. So I think Umsinga for me has played a really fertile place from which one can draw an imagination, a set of concepts and themes that are otherwise difficult to find in Durban, for example. Funny enough, my uncles were taxi drivers and taxi owners in Johannesburg. And I encountered Johannesburg Umsinga, which is to say, as a young boy, like from the ages of 6, whenever I'd go home for the holidays, they would talk about Johannesburg, you know. And there's a vocabulary that was used to talk about eGoli, you know. And in my mind, it was very imaginative and vibrant way that they spoke about this stuff. And then I'd encounter, you know, telenovelas on television about Johannesburg. And it seemed to be slightly different to what they would, kind of how they would talk about their lives in Johannesburg. Mostly they were based in the hostels, you know. And so when I first came to Johannesburg, all of them had passed at the time that I came to Johannesburg. And somehow it felt like I was chasing their ghosts, chasing their shadows between JPs and Togoza and further south, you know. So yeah, it's funny to say that I encountered Johannesburg Umsinga, but this is the place that Umsinga holds in my heart.
Let's go back to that first pilot live performance and the notion of Ilenyama, dark cloud. Yeah. Now that's something you took from your engagement, your experience of Umsinga, but at the same time you also fused it with digital terminology, obviously the cloud, remote computing. Yeah. How were you drawing off these two and integrating them in this way? I'm particularly interested in the original notion of the Inyama, okay, the dark cloud.
So in everyday Sisulu, Ifelimnyama is, as you would translate in English, dark cloud, and it's connotation of an omen or a kind of unpleasant encounter or incidents or something of that nature. So there's a kind of very accessible translation that exists at that level. I connect that with a moment, I think I was around 8 or 10 or something, and we'd arrive during the December holidays. And people in the area were talking about these scientists who had gone up this mountaintop. This mountain is called Intanyan. And they were digging for water. I imagine spring water. You know, I was too young and I didn't ask, I didn't inquire very much. But this mountain is a very, very like tall, present mountain, you know, and kind of looks over the various villages around it. And on most days, it's under the veil of like clouds. That's how high it goes. And, you know, it's known that you don't go up that mountain. And on some occasions, they would say that there was a snake that occupies the top of this mountain, and the top of this mountain is a lake. So much so that the local general dealer had a mural of the snake with 12 heads. And I was like, my God, I was like, what's going on up there, you know? And the mountain, it feels so close, yet it's so far. And this incident happens, and it's out of my imagination, you know? When this project came to be, obviously this engagement with beadwork, I was taking this from Amapinga, which is a subsection of AmaZulu, a subgroup of AmaZulu who were quote-unquote unconverted, the non-converted. They embodied as well as practiced this beadwork, the Zulu love letter as it's popularly called. And so as we were undertaking this exploration at the Phansi Museum, looking at kind of these vernacular algorithms through beadwork, my mind would slowly drift towards Umsinga and kind of search there. And from there, this mountain begins to come closer and get closer. And then I start plotting these connections of like this event where the scientists had gone up a mountaintop in search of water. I mean, I remember that they said when they came back, they had found that it was not a reliable spring because it had a very high salt content. I mean, I don't know what chemical it would be at a technical level. And then I started to think about the snake. It is said that in Kanyamba, the snake that is said to kind of occupy this lake bed moved the cloud. And on two occasions, it had moved from Intanyana to another lake region. And it had moved with this dark cloud. And I thought, okay, something's there. And then when one thinks about technology and the presence and the centrality of the cloud as a storage device, one can also think of the cloud as a storage device for water. Into this, you can bring Unomkhubulwane, the goddess of fertility, as understood in Nguni folklore. So suddenly, we go from this everyday use of Ifu, Ifelimnyama, the dark cloud, into this kind of supernatural through Unomkhubulwane. And you connect it to a kind of very practical, the rain dance, you know, which is connected to notions of land and belonging and so on, you know. And so the cloud, from this perspective, becomes a really fertile place to converge a number of preoccupations that I had at the time that, you know, helps me move from forms of scientific and technological thinking, both at a technical as well as at a kind of fictive level. And I can bring that to connect to very specific knowledge structures that exist in the Nguni tradition and folklore, as well as rituals and practices of this nature. So this is how the cloud came to be a place from which I could draw a lot of these ideas and inspirations, and I could bring them back to the cloud. What this allowed me to do is to produce a film or a project from which people who are not engaged in science fiction or technological discourse, for example, from Msinga, could instantly latch onto. At the same time, I could present it in the context of ISEA, for example, with people who are engaged in a different cloud phenomena, if I can use it that way, right? And I think it crystallized a placement or a posturing or a positioning of myself and how I want to practice and kind of in what language I want to move between communities of practice.
What I found particularly interesting in going back to that 2018 performance at ASEA was your unapologetic use of Zulu. And I know you've expressed the aim of devising a Zulu language dictionary of technical terms, but phrase used that your grandmother could understand. And I was struck by that because I know there have been a few writers, Zulu language writers, who've tried to write science fiction using Zulu, and all have expressed a lot of how difficult it is and that it involves actually coining and inventing a large number of terms just to be able to write about such subject matter. And it struck me with particularly the film version of Dark Cloud, which we'll have a link to in the show notes, because I think everybody should watch that film. It's really beautiful and evocative. Is your Zulu seems very, very fluent. There's no sense that you're struggling with terminology, yet you're often discussing what are clearly quite technical topics using Zulu. How have you managed that process of translation?
I can also add mistranslations as well, which I feel are very useful ways and methods of expanding that which we currently have. I think the need to produce knowledge in local languages is critical and it's important. On the one hand, it allows the language to keep abreast with the world around it. And there's this Indian-based scholar, Gautam Ban, who talks about injecting new meanings to existing terms and inventing new terms for existing phenomena, roughly paraphrasing his work here. So this notion of inventing new words for existing practices and injecting new definitions for existing words is one that I think is really important for me. And in this work, for example, I did not really invent any terms in this very limited glossary that I've developed whilst making the film, but rather what I was more interested in is the etymology of terms. So one that I might use, for example, is ugesi. In isiZulu, electricity or power is ugesi. In a language where, say, inventions such as the fridge or the motor car or the mic, one simply puts an I in front of, so the fridge becomes ifridge, motor car becomes imoto, so on and so forth. Cell phone becomes iselfone. Yeah. So for this term that has a word that is clearly isiZulu, it does not borrow from the English, it's very interesting. It's interesting when you follow what is ugesi, where does the word come from, what did it mean before we had the Edison iteration of electricity or power. And where does this journey, the sojourn in following this term, take us, right? What it does for me indicates at that very early point is that there was an imagination, there was a use or utility or a production of power. It may not be the power that we live with every day here, but I'm interested in what that power might have been. How was it produced? Where did it start? And so there's something about that term, for example. The other term that we put together, or to constructed, was the term umkhombandlela. Umkhombandlela was used to talk about the GPS. Now, ukhomba is to point, indlela is the way. So GPS, umkhombandlela. This is not a new term in isiZulu. I could use this with almost any isiZulu speaker. Without explaining what a GPS is, they could make the connections, and there you have it, right? And so this notion of playing with translation and giving definitions to existing terms and bringing together two terms that, when they brought together, they express a new meaning, is a method of this translation. I did this with the person who did the voiceover. My isiZulu is okay. I don't struggle with it, but in no way am I the expert. There are people who are much more dexterous and a much better use and utility of the language. But Manila Sinzele, who did the voiceover, as I was scripting this, I was sending stuff to him, and he would send it back to me, and it's okay, this works. And he says, no, it doesn't work. And he suggests something. And so this process of moving between translation in order for us to arrive at a term that captures quite accurately, say, a term that defines a particular kind of technology, was one that was in community. It was not something that had come out from me. And you would notice that in my projects, I'm often bringing together various makers and producers of knowledge. And I, if anything, just try to come up with the way that people can communicate across disciplines and practices. So this is how I've been thinking about the notion of translation. I think it is very, very important for us to normalize this speaking in a language that is non-English, because it helps us understand that the isiZulu language is rich amongst other languages. You know, so I'm doing this in isiZulu. Imagine if someone does this in another language that is of South Africa. And what does the act of translating across Sesotho, for example, and isiZulu bring us? And then how do we bring like someone who speaks isiXhosa, for example, to be in that conversation? And again, the intention or the aim is not what we are translating, but it's that messy process of translation and what it brings up as a result of that activity is what I'm most interested in. And I definitely like to do more of this kind of stuff, you know. One can move from, say, language and to talk, say, like, if you were to bring a herbalist to be in conversation with, I don't know, like an astrophysicist, for these people to engage in terminologies that are outside of one's everyday practice does something to the act of producing knowledge, you know. And I think this, in my view, is the unique offering that we can bring to the fields of science and technology and innovation.
Let's move on. And I had the pleasure this year of encountering a new stage in your work. And this was featured at Laura Farber and Brenton Mart's exhibition at UJ, their eminent colleges, and it featured the film Deserter. Can you bring us up to speed with what you drew on to create that really remarkable, compelling film? I watched it many times. I saw you doing the performance lecture again with it. And that was a collaboration with François Knutzer and Amy Wilson. And I think what was particularly powerful influence there was the thinking around STI, science, technology, and innovation in Africa, coming from the Zimbabwean Clapton Mavhunga.
Yeah, I mean, to land you there, so Ifeli Mnyama was drawing from Mapungubwe as a site, and Francois and Amy have done a lot of work around kind of the techno-political, and we've been fans of each other's work for a while, and we've kind of been trying to find ways to collaborate and come together. And so we did through this DATA, the Institute of Technological Consciousness. And the idea was to kind of allow us to remain engaged in the sites and in the mode in which we were kind of already producing, at the same time allowing for the convergence of these practices to present something new. And so the sites that we looked at this point was DATA, which is a location in Limpopo. It exists, and it's kind of significance, historical and current day relevance. And DATA is not too far from Mapungubwe, you know. It's not too far from the great ruins of Zimbabwe. And we kind of wanted to stay within this region and do deeper work, at the same time start to link these various sites of significance with each other and put them in conversation with each other. And so in settling on a location, then we started to think of whose work might we draw from. So Clapperton Chakaneta Mavhunga was one. So he's currently based at MIT in Zimbabwe, born and raised and spent time in Johannesburg as well as part of his studies. And then we started to think about the massive mega projects that had followed the wave of independence on the continent, a lot of which were successful in some respects, but failures in many respects as well. And from that was the non-aligned movements as well. There was kind of thinking of a different relationship with technology, thinking differently about politics and what we do with ourselves and society and the future. So we are kind of drawing from this very broad field of ideas, from the political to the social. And in using the work of Mavhunga, he was also mentor for the project. So we had spent quite a bit of time between reading his books, talking to him, reading the books, talking to him, scripting, and then returning to him again. So there's kind of like this cyclical process that we had undertaken.
Could you, for our listeners, just briefly summarize the main import of Mavhunga's ideas?
Sure. The one was the mobile laboratory. So the mobile laboratory, he was looking at how the laboratory, it does not only take form in a fixed way or doesn't take form. It's not a fixed location or place. The idea that the laboratory is mobile, as people move, so does the laboratory. Yeah, the practice remains. And so we felt this was a really kind of compelling proposition. The other was his question of what does STI do for Africa. And so the impetus from there is to draw specifically at practices from the continents of the continents. And then to push it one more, he's been talking about this idea of the thinker-doer, which is to say it is not enough to only produce theory. Someone has to implement this stuff in order for it to have currency in the world that is kind of largely capitalistic. So these are the three main, I would say, these are the three main kind of imports, to use your term, that we have played with.
And how did that translate into the film? Because the film was remarkable. I mean, with these strangely garbed figures clearly in transit, carrying the laths on their backs.
Sure.
You know, strong echoes of Afrofuturism, but not the Wakanda kind of comic book gloss, much rather a sort of constructivism that came through the images in the film.
So let's go from Mavhunga's notion of the laboratory as a mobile station, so to speak, and think of Sanusis or shamans of the continent, most of whom are wanderers. They roam. They are seldom located in a place. They're kind of moving around. And, I mean, Credo Motu is said to have traveled great distances as well, and this kind of as part of his initiation, no? And so here we can take an academic who's writing about this stuff, pull his work and locate it with a Sanusi that is very popular in the South. Now, Credo Motu is one of many Sanusis of this region who wonder. And here I play with this idea of wonder as with the A and the O. So kind of to be in meditation, wandering, but at the same time roaming as a method of meditating as well. So there's a very clear line that we're drawing there. So one of the lines in the film says, design a backpack which also contains the cosmos. And again, we're drawing from the idea of moving with the laboratory, and the laboratory kind of being this thing that you can open up and explode out and explode in. Now, this notion of a backpack from which a cosmos is contained can be thought of in shamanistic practices of the South, where healers and transcendentalists have a kind of very intimate and technical knowledge of, say, the healing qualities on one level. The ability to conjure and capture consciousness is perhaps another one. We also feature in there the thinking of Amilcar Cabral, who's kind of maybe not so much coined the term, but definitely popularized the notion of agronomics. And he was thinking about the anti-imperialist movement of his region as not only liberating the human, the kind of the oppressed, but also liberating the natural world, you know? And so there's a way in which the film is kind of this fictive realm or objects, but it's speaking and it's drawing from events and locations and thinkers that you can point to. And so in this way, it moves beyond the idea that it's merely speculative. It's an evocative idea. We are trying to connect it to the everyday, and to the very practical, historical, and present-day movements that are political, economical, and otherwise. And so Mavhunga, I think Mavhunga does this really, really well, because he is very much about African or artists of this place can't only make films that sit as entertainment, that sits as theory, that cannot be enacted. And so so kind of taking that line and that guidance, we wanted to embed this work in places with people that a lot of us can identify with and we can see and or read about and know.
Now, when you did your live performance in the gallery, your performance took the form of moving. You moved between different locations inside the gallery with the audience following you, and you carried a suitcase. And each time you stopped to sit down and deliver more of your lecture, the suitcase was opened and these bizarre constructed object sculptures came out and were handed to the audience, which I really liked. There was that physical engagement with the objects from the suitcase. Again, it was the performance lecture, which is clearly a form you're very comfortable with. What was the import of your lecture and your performance in relation to the film?
We made the film, And in the process of research, a lot of the stuff that you land up with is shoved away, and the audience engages with maybe 10% of that. And the idea was to think of how to mobilize this deep and extensive research that we'd accumulated over a year and a half or so. And I took those notes and I started to put together a kind of speculative document. A document that on the one hand would say, acknowledge the thinkers and the writers that we are drawing from, at the same time connect them with people that we cannot quite readily cite or reference or acknowledge, yeah? And so from that, I started to think about, now that this stuff has been written up, how can I make it mobile? How can I move it in a way that is evocative and has a sense of aesthetic value? So this performance then came to be. And what I was trying to do with the performance is to expand the universe of the film. So it's to say, if you've engaged with the film, it sets you in many different directions. And along those directions, I wanted to almost accompany you with some notes that start to expand. When the film says this, it's from this thinker, from this writer that it's drawing from. When the film says this, this is what they're drawing on. If this costume looks this way, it is for this reason. And so the performance lecture allows one to build a greater body and kind of starts to populate the universe of the film, almost to explain the physics of the universe and the laws of the universe. So this was the impetus of the performance. And as you say that I'm moving from station to station. And what I was trying to imagine here is if you were to take the institute that was at Data and you place it within, say, a gallery context, what might it look like? But of course, in the performance, I had three stations. And the idea was to think of each station as a department. There's a sonic and resonance department. There is the department of the objects of power, these strange constructions that Francois and Amy had put together. And the thinking there was to bring into the conversation these incomplete prototypes of objects that were created at the institute. And as the last scientist who occupied this long lineage of head scientist, I'm pulling together the notes that we found across the various sites of the institutes across the continent. I'm pulling together and kind of creating a register of the objects that we encountered at these places. And so in a way, the film then becomes a kind of manual for these objects, for these ideas, these diary entries, and these meditations that have encountered across these ruins, you know? And the idea of passing over the objects is to, again, kind of bring a tangible value to the film, which is otherwise something that's kind of on a wall or on a screen, you know? So I hope this kind of starts to orientate you and the audience of where the performance was trying to go.
Could you imagine taking that film to Msinga and screening it there? And what kind of reaction would you imagine getting?
I want to say yes, I could. I think the value or the interesting points about the film is that people find their unique points of entry. It's either an object that they can identify, however in the film it's been repurposed and used and appropriated in some way. And from there someone latches and that's kind of the point of entry and off they go. So yes, I do think they are very accessible visual cues that most people can latch onto. However, they don't meet those objects as they know them in the everyday. Yeah, I don't think the film sits comfortably in any one location, simply because it is not loyal to one location. It's trying to be loyal to a multiple of places at the same time. The voiceover is in English, and it's this inaudible, distorted voice, which was very deliberate because we were struggling to think of a language to use in communicating what people see. And so we thought, okay, if you're going to use the English, then we have to distort it a bit, you know? And so at the level of a language, perhaps people might not kind of follow all the way through. The spoken is just one way that people can communicate and exchange ideas with the film, you know? So I think it is quite possible. I mean, another question to ask, if we take it to, say, Limpopo and kind of show it there, kind of what becomes the response. I then wonder if you show it to an audience that does not have the lived experience of the subjects that we are talking about in the film, how do they engage with it, right? And I feel in both cases, both audiences do not work comfortably. They kind of, no one has mastery over the film than the other. Like, there's no authority, so to speak. If anything, we are trying to decentralize the authority of an audience, you know, and rather kind of have each person who engages with it to have a portion of this to access a portion of the universe, but not the entire universe. Because, I mean, as an isiZulu speaker and someone who's tied to an isiZulu heritage, to a Zulu heritage, I'm also aware of the dominance of isiZulu as a language of communication and dissemination after the English in South Africa. So I was also trying to push back against that.
That's true. I must say, on Wits campus, the only black indigenous language events that I've seen publicized over the last few years, there've been a Zulu language film festival, we've had Zulu cultural events, and I suppose there's also the perhaps rather problematic link with the more extreme forms of Zulu nationalism, as we've experienced over the years. So quite challenging to be working in a Zulu linguistic space, but negotiating these aspects of language nationalism.
Sure, it's important. I mean, you even look at government national campaigns. Often it's in English, and the next language that is on offer is isiZulu, you know? So one has to work with these tools in a very careful way.
And similarly, you've certainly in your more sort of future-orientated thinking, you've seen a role for artistic research as offering different ways of engaging with indigenous knowledge. Can you unpack that?
I don't have a background in arts making in the sense that I'm not trained as an artist. I don't have an academic background either. And I find myself in both places. I'm now doing my MPhil at the African Center for Cities. And so this artistic research allows me, on the one hand, to undertake, validate, and valorize a set of ideas that do not emerge from academia. And the process of validating them is often undermined by a kind of academic rigor, an academic kind of method. So the artistic research has some credibility in the world. So I kind of want to exploit this tool, yeah? At the same time, because I'm not trained in this mode of art making, I can't claim mastery over it, right? So then I can say, all right, maybe I can escape here and, like, you know, hang with my academics and then take some things there and kind of bring it over to the other side. In short, this mode of artistic research allows one to liberate ideas that you are trying to validate and kind of valorize without needing them to contend with what academia would require these ideas to do. And you're able to draw on aspects that people can, to some degree, agree upon. And then exploit that initial agreement and say, okay, so if you agree that this happened, who's to say this didn't happen, right? So we don't have to resolve that answer of if this didn't happen. But what it does is open someone to the possibility, the likelihood that something else is possible beyond that which academia tells us. And the artistic research mode is one way that you can wage this kind of, I was going to say war, but it's not war, can wield this currency, you know, that is artistic research. So it kind of helps do that. And, you know, I think slowly academics are amenable. They open to the persuasion of the artistic research mode, you know. This is my happy place. I can escape some traps. I can dodge some complicated and restrictive conditions of operating and trading. Equally importantly, we have to find ways to make this stuff interesting, exciting, and inviting to younger minds. And the way to do that is using art making or artistic practice. So the artistic mode is useful for these multiple reasons I've just mentioned.
I strongly agree with that interpretation of artistic research, and certainly that's what I've seen as an important aspect of using such a modality here in Africa, in that it is this, I wouldn't say safe space, but it's a space in which one can bring ideas together.
Possible
that
space.
Wouldn't be easily combined or put into dialogue. And that leads me into your understanding of indigenous knowledge systems, which you actively bring into the space of artistic research. And I'm thinking an ex-colleague of mine, a brilliant young scholar and artist, Jessie Foley. She gave a paper at the first ARA conference that we had, and it was actually about the difficulty of working with students around indigenous knowledge, and how students, black students, would say to her, this is not a topic for public discussion. Leave it alone. And she found that quite difficult to deal with, because I think she was coming into this discussion, this engagement with the students, with the idea of allowing them, bring in your indigenous knowledge. You know, I'm not going to restrict you. You know, I'm offering you the opportunity to bring your indigenous knowledge into art making, in her case, performance art. And the students were saying, like, no, hold on. You're nodding. You've certainly experienced that aspect of indigenous knowledge, that it isn't for everyone. There's actually the people who've acquired indigenous knowledge have often gone through a lot in terms of trials, tribulations, and are not keen to just open it up and pass it on to, you know, anyone who wants it.
I often start with problematizing the term indigenous in this indigenous knowledge system. So if one looks at the etymology of the term indigenous, we come to have it through this French term, the indigène, which is something that is without value, something with hands open, nothing of its own. Yeah, and was used to describe the subjugated person, right? And so to call ourselves indigenous in there, we claim a very problematic and complicated term to start with, yeah? And I think that same kind of caution has to be carried throughout the engagement with this IKS. What I do acknowledge is that there are, say, at this point, two, possibly more camps. The one that says we need to shed light onto these practices. The other says, no, this is sacred and it cannot be discussed. Yeah. So the risk that comes with concealing is that we have a tendency to conceal to erasure, right? Because this has never been public knowledge or a knowledge that has been engaged with vigorously, there's a risk that it recedes into obscurity. That's the risk of the one. The risk of the other then this kind of becomes free for all, and it's kind of very easily dismissed as just mere hearsay. Yeah, I acknowledge both points. From the case that you've shared, what I think is the important element is for people to understand that you have to work for this stuff. You know, it's not a free for all. It requires some kind of sustained and committed engagements with it. And so this is the value. So when you said that, you know, for a lot of people who've amassed and accumulated a particular expertise, let's maybe call it that, or a grasp of a certain set of concepts, they've had to go through a particular kind of training, yeah, where they have to give something in order for them to get this other thing. This is maybe something that I think we ought to engage with and think about, what is it that someone on the other side of this knowledge has to offer up in exchange of this information, you know? And that process, that exchange, is one that I think is worth engaging with. The position that I take is that this stuff that I'm talking about, it's mine, which is to say, I have relatives, I have friends, and I'm part of a society that have contributed and kind of presented this stuff. I have another generation of people who will not otherwise engage with this material if we don't find ways to kind of bring light to them, right? I'm also very clear and aware of the line. So I've engaged, say I've seen performances, not so much in Durban, but certainly in Cape Town and Johannesburg, where, say, artists would burn in paper, for example. And some of the complications that come with that if the due diligence is not done before and post this event of burning impepho, for example, you know. And so if you were to engage, say, with healers or with people who are very kind of conversant in this trade, they can explain to you what are the ramifications of burning impepho in a large audience and kind of introducing certain objects or gadgets into that room where impepho is being burnt. So there's something certainly worth thinking about there and finding a way and a framework of engaging with indigenous knowledge systems in a way that does not bring them forward as a spectacle and as some kind of quote-unquote ritual that has been brought into a gallery and has, you know, it's like, personally, I think that trade is problematic and I think we need to think of it. Now, this is not to discredit those who do that work. I think what they are offering is an opportunity for us to think about how does this knowledge posture and how is it packaged in the context of art making, in the context of academic writing, which has a very complicated with that very knowledge, yeah? And then how does it circulate within broader society of South Africa? How does it circulate amongst black and non-black actors in a space? How does it circulate with other Africans and how does it circulate in the global discourse? For me, this is something that we need to be thinking about and doing a bit more work and discoursing around. And then we can kind of get to the next step, which is a much more technical application of how do we undertake this stuff? How do we claim it? And on what grounds do we claim it? And there's a question here at the level of an artist. There's a question here at the level of a curator.
Yes. And how does artistic research facilitate that process?
I think a gesturing, often in the work that I do, I gesture towards an idea, I gesture towards an act or a ritual. So I don't perform the ritual, but I am able to assemble a number of objects and postures that to someone who knows of that ritual, who's observed that ritual and participated in that ritual, you get it, you know? And so this idea of gesturing is for me one tool that I utilize through an artistic research mode that is able to engage with otherwise explosive and complicated practices that are not for public consumption, but something about this practice is worth public attention. And so I would gesture to it. I would not do it.
My last question, where do you plan to be going in the near future? You registered for a degree?
I'm undertaking my MPhil at the African Center for Cities at UCT. And my future thinking, my artistic practice has had two kind of areas of focus. The one is around technology and indigeneity. The other is around space and indigeneity. And here I've had an interest in understanding how black folk might understand, articulate, and produce space as a way of contributing to spatial practice and urban studies. And so my research question is looking at how language, isiZulu language, as a repository can start to give us some clues around how space is produced, how space is understood and articulated from the isiZulu language. And from there, how have people moved, say, from rural areas into urban areas? And how has the isiZulu language expanded as a result of that migration? And so the question is, what terms, what concepts and ideas are in the isiZulu that we can take and bring forth as an account of spatial imagination and a spatial practice by the isiZulu person, by the Zulu person? And hopefully out of this, I could draw other people from other regions of the continent to investigate through their own languages how is space produced, understood, etc., etc., and slowly accumulate a working group or a reference group that can slowly assemble spatial productions of the South that is drawn from languages of this place. So this is a future thinking. The other one that I'm also interested in, kind of returning to the place of technology and indigeneity, it would be interesting to me to think of one framework that could invite people who come from very different backgrounds and professions to be in conversation over a sustained period with enough resources to speak across disciplines. So as I had mentioned earlier on, what would be the conditions that one could invite a healer to be in conversation with an astrophysicist, for example? how could one work with a transcendentalist or a Sanusi who would, say, engage with a computer scientist and so on and so forth? Not for the sake of kind of drawing boundaries between the two, but rather to see like what kinds of tensions, kind of overlaps, and shared notions exist across these various disciplines. And what does it do for the production of science, technology, and innovation from the continent? I think from that process of translating, mistranslating those frustrations that might emerge, something quite interesting might come up out of that. So I'd like to do this at some point. I don't know when. Perhaps resources would determine when this happens, but I think it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Russell, I look forward to you taking that and making it happen. And anyway, I can contribute from my side. I would be very interested to do that.
Expect an invitation.
Great to catch up.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a dialogue between myself, Krista Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wit School of Arts, and my guest, the South African artist, cultural producer, artistic researcher, and filmmaker, Russell Hlongwane. This podcast was hosted and produced by myself, with technical production by Elna Schutz. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Lee Rosevere and is used under a Creative Commons license.